Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Well, hello, everybody out there. This is an odd venue for us, and we're excited about the chance to visit with you about our experiences and our connection of our experiences to the work of Alan Keith Lucas. We're trying to do this with a couple of different technology venues, so I'm finding myself struggling with knowing where to look. I want to look at the phone because I assume that's where you all are, and certainly at the webcam and then at the other computer that has the PowerPoint. So if you see my eyes darting around, it's because I haven't figured out the technology yet. It's exciting to us to have a chance to share with you what we've learned in our journey. Particularly, I want to take you back a little bit to how all this began for me and in my connections with Alan Keith Lucas some years ago. I met Alan Keith Lucas, who was a social work educator, had been in the child welfare system for many years, and then was consultant to a number of children's homes, faith-based Christian children's homes across the country. I met him when I was a caseworker at the South Texas Children's Home in Beeville, Texas, a long, long time ago. I'll just say that. Keith came once a year to help us do our work there at the children's home, to understand more about how to be effective with the children God had placed in our care. I was particularly impressed with Keith because he was cerebral and real at the same time. He was somebody who had thought deeply and loved children deeply, and somebody who gave advice and counsel that actually was difference-making in our practice there at the children's home. My experience with him there taught me a lot about how important it was to value the parents of these children and the families of the children whose care we had become entrusted with. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those principles with you today, some of the things that I learned from him, and those things that are available in a lot of his literature, which he has left behind and which NACSW makes available to you for purchase as well. And then Beth and I are going to talk a bit about the adoption experience and how those principles actually played themselves out and as we applied them in our experience together, so that you can hear a bit about not only our life together, but her reunion experience, our relationship building experience with her birth family. We're going to take a couple of times when we stop speaking and invite Rick to open the mics in case you've got questions at that point. So if you'll just jot your questions down as they occur to you, there'll be a couple of times during the presentation when we stop and take questions. The South Texas Children's Home is actually a Baptist children's home, obviously in South Texas, that accepts children for care who for one reason or another can't be at home living with their parents. Sometimes that means for 6 months or a year while the families are able to clarify what they're going to be able to do in terms of parenting their children. Sometimes children are there for a number of years and actually grow up at the children's home and graduate from high school there and actually also receive support for college there as well. So the home parents or house parents in that setting really are sometimes short-term temporary parental substitutes or supplements and sometimes become longer-term parental figures in these children's lives. And I found as a caseworker there that a number of times those were some of the biggest barriers or issues in working with children was trying to help children figure out how to relate to a number of different parental figures in their lives, how to help these supplemental or substitute parents that we called house parents to value the experience of the children with their birth families who may have been in a situation where where everything that happened between the children and the parents wasn't positive or healthy. And it was the principles of Alan Keith Lucas that really helped me form some of those concepts and work with some of those house parents and children around those relationships. One of the things that Keith taught us early on is that you should never rule out a child's biological family. In fact, he talked about the concept of the psychological parent. So the awareness that even when a parent is absent from the child's life for a period of time or a lengthy period of time, that child's biological family, birth parent, birth siblings, are still very much a part of the child's experience, thought process. And we know developmentally that's true. I think about how Beth through the years has thought about and we've talked about, who do I look like? Whose mannerisms do I have? How do I resemble, or how am I similar to my family of origin? And how am I similar to and resemble mom and dad now? Even when it's our sense that a child's biological family is inadequate in some way, hasn't been able to do the parenting or do the parenting adequately or enough or correctly enough that CPS or the parent or someone else felt a change needed to be made. Even in those cases that Keith said, the biological parent continues to be an important part of the equation, and we shouldn't rule out the child's investment in them, care for them, need for them. He also said that part of what is sort of dangerous in substitute care or foster care adoptions, child care, is the notion that we might somehow have the right to judge other people, to decide who's good and who's bad, who's a good parent, who's a bad parent. And Keith suggested that whether we're talking about parents or any human beings that we're working with and caring about, that we don't have the right or the ability to judge people in terms of what they deserve. That really that right is reserved to God, that we've been called to love people and encourage people and nurture relationships, and to recognize that all of us have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All of us are dependent on God's goodness, and so it's never about who's worthy or unworthy. It's about God's grace in all of our lives. He also taught us that one of the fundamental problems we could make in child care is the notion that we had the right or ability to sort of control what happened in other people's lives, that it's always better to help people find their own way than it is to try and tell them what to do or manage what they do, however subtly. And so there were times when we talked, for example, at the children's home about if a parent weren't visiting, if we could figure out what the barriers were and try and overcome those barriers instead of judging them for being bad and not showing up for visits. Keith believed fundamentally that relationships matter, that it really is about cultivating personal relationships that are born out of respect for people, and that part of what we have to figure out in child care or foster care or adoption is what kind of relationship we can have with people, how much and in what venues, what ways we can do that. One of the things that that happened for me as an adoptive parent is our agency was a closed adoption agency, not an open adoption agency, and so we didn't have direct contact with birth families, but it occurred to me that there would probably be a time when one or both of my adopted children would want to meet or seek a relationship with a birth parent or both birth parents. And what I was concerned about was the gap of information that would be there after a child had so many years of growing up in our home. And so one of the things I did every year on Beth's birthday is I wrote a letter to her birth mother and a letter to her birth father and basically outlined what kind of person she was and was becoming, what had happened in the previous year, how she did in school, what subjects she loved, whether she was playing t-ball or starting piano lessons, or how she got along with her big brother. One letter I got to share about the wonderful experience of when she discovered Christ and gave her life to the Lord as her Savior. And so each year there was a letter that updated about her life, and those letters I sent then to the children's home to be kept there for the birth parents to pick up if and when they wanted to. And Beth will talk a little bit about later about the role those letters ended up playing in her relationship. Another thing that Keith talked about a lot was that it's really important to remember that people are people. They're subjects, not objects. And so not to just, you know, label people as, you know, well, there's a mother who didn't want her child or was in circumstances that wouldn't let her keep her child, but to really relate to her as a person. And so we started very young talking with both children about these incredible people who were their birth parents, who had many gifts and talents and strengths and wonderful things about them. I remember telling, if you're on a webcam, you can tell how true this is. I remember telling Beth there are many ways that you're like your birth parents. One of them is you have gorgeous thick hair, which clearly you didn't get from me. And she has incredible music ability, which clearly she didn't get from me. And we made it okay for her to talk about these folks who were in her awareness, these birth parents who were in her awareness. I remember one time when she was maybe seven, and she began to cry and said, "Mom, I just miss my birth mother." It was a part of her life stage when she was thinking about where have I come from and where are the people who started my life. And my response to that was that I miss them too, and that it's okay to miss them, and that maybe someday we'll get to know them and not have to miss them anymore. That's directly connected to Keith Lucas' teaching. Alan also talked a lot about the importance of our examining our own motives as helpers. And, you know, I hear a lot about, I've had people through the years say to me, "Oh, you and your husband are so wonderful because you adopted these children and took them into your home." And, you know, my response to that is, we are so wonderfully blessed. You know, I think Keith taught us that you got to know whether you're an adoptive parent or whatever kind of helping you engage in as social workers or case managers. The helping that we do because it's the right and loving thing to do, not because we think we're better or we think that what we will do will work, but because God calls us to do the right thing, and so we do the right thing, and He gets. The glory because he's the one that makes things work, not us. A couple of other principles before we take a break and hear your questions that sort of guided our experience with adoption, particularly with the words of Alan Keith Lucas kind of ringing through our lives. He said it's really important to recognize people's strengths as well as their limitations, to not be so focused on what people have done wrong or failed to do or couldn't do. The recognition that we all as human beings are fallible, and that's okay. Being fallible doesn't mean that we're not also capable of incredible courage and incredible strength and incredible resilience and unselfishness. And sometimes it's easier to see what's wrong than to see what's strong in another person. I've now met Beth's birth mother, and we've talked about how difficult the circumstances of her life were at that time. And part of what I wrote in the letters every year and what I've shared with her since then is how deeply grateful I am that she made the courageous decision to carry that pregnancy to term. It might have been much easier for her to choose abortion. She didn't choose abortion. She chose to carry the pregnancy to term. She chose to bear the difficult 9 months and produce this incredible human being that you see sitting to the side of me, who'll speak to you in just a few minutes. She transcended herself and her circumstances and showed incredible courage, and I'll be grateful to her for the rest of my life. Sort of in the same vein, Keith said that there really isn't a significant difference between good and bad people. It's not like, oh, the bad birth parents and the good adoptive parents. But the difference between good and bad is insignificant when we compare the standard of who God has created us to be and really how we all fail in that regularly and are dependent on God's grace, not the judgment of God or the judgment of others. I think that makes us recognize, too, that particularly in the adoption triangle, the experience is pretty much the same for all of us, that there is grief and loss and joy and capacity for all members of the adoption triangle. And that's part of what Keith was trying to teach us. We experienced loss, my husband and I, with the realization that we weren't able to have children biologically. Jennifer experienced loss when she recognized she was pregnant and wouldn't be able to raise this child as her daughter in her home. Beth experienced loss as she, through the years, recognized that there were people that she's related to who she hasn't gotten to grow up with and to know at those critical points in her life. And so there's inadequacy and loss for all of us, and there's great joy in this experience for all of us. And then finally, one of the things that Keith was so careful about was to teach us it's very easy to label people, but it's almost always fundamentally wrong. To call a child unwanted, to call somebody, you know, illegitimate or less kind words than that, fundamentally wrong. And the same thing with labeling birth parents and other folks, to call me infertile, wrong, because there are many ways that I'm fertile. Not having a baby isn't one of them, but the label of infertile, the label of unwed, the label of illegitimate are mistakes on our part because they focus on the negative. And Keith was very careful to say that people are more than a label, which really brings us to maybe one of the most important things Keith taught me, and that is that we don't help people by protecting them from the consequences of their decision. He wasn't a broad brush, sugar coating, kind of globally everything's wonderful, don't deal with reality kind of guy. In fact, he said there are three principles of helping, and the first of them is to acknowledge reality, the reality of everybody's situation involved. The truth is, I wasn't able to bear children. The truth is, Jennifer wasn't able to raise Beth. The truth is, Beth wasn't able to grow up with this incredible woman who was her birth mother. Another part of the truth is, she got to grow up with her dad and me, and that was pretty special, too. He said the second part of helping beyond reality is, you know, for us to say, given what has happened, now what do we do? And what do we do in the context of empathic response? So not just here's what the reality is, but I understand your reality and I care about it. It matters. I know that this must hurt and be difficult. And then the third level of helping, a requirement of good helping, is support. And he actually talked about, you know, taking it from I care about the fact that you hurt to I'm here for you. How can I help you through this? In fact, he even made the connection between these three principles and the Trinity. So Keith said, think about it really, that God the Father represents reality, things, the facts, things as they are. Jesus Christ, the Son, the most incredible picture of empathy ever, the one who recognized what we feel, who felt all things, endured all things, that there's no grief or pain or loss or challenge that we experience that he has not experienced and understands. And then support, as exemplified by the Holy Spirit, the support, he who is always with us in the world to help us navigate and negotiate the challenges we experience. So how does that apply to adoption? Well, in adoption, we acknowledge the realities, the challenges, the difficulties. We empathize with and care about the pain and the loss. And then we make a commitment to support each other through the process. Those are the principles that that Keith taught me at the children's home and that we've talked about throughout our journey and have made a difference for us in being able to say, we love each other and we are family. And there's a bigger family out there that's a part of who we are as well. So when we apply those principles, then what does that mean? Keith said, first of all, people need to know that they're accepted. Birth families, I think, need to know that they're accepted, that they're not judged, that they're not labeled, that they're not cast aside or seen as people who are unworthy in some way. And that we're not going to write them off because there was a point in time, or many points in time, when they weren't able to fulfill their parenting responsibilities. And that there's not a time when we're going to stop caring about them. Secondly, that Christians, as Christians, we understand the finite nature and fallible or sinful behavior of human beings, all persons. And that, you know, we're all made in the image of God and redemption and grace are available to us. I love this third point, and I'm going to read that directly off the slide because it may sort of sum up the whole thing. You know, the wisdom of the world says, you know, if you behave, I will love you. If you do what I expect of you, if you meet my expectations, if you meet my standards, I will love you. But Jesus approached us very different than that. He didn't say, behave and I will love you. He said to us, I love you. I love you. Just as you are, I love you. So behave. So in effect, you know, when I make the decision to follow God's law, follow God's instruction, follow God's direction in my life, it's not because I think God won't love and accept me if I don't. It's because he has loved me and I love him back and I want to please him. Maybe the last application of that I think is fundamentally important and will sort of lead into your hearing Beth's story is the bottom line is if a child can't find something to love and appreciate in their family of origin, in their birth parents, it's going to be very hard for them to find anything to love and appreciate in themselves. And as a parent to my children, the more they love themselves, appreciate God's gifts inside them, how wonderfully and specially they're made and created, the plans God has for them, the happier I am. And so anything that helps that happen, that's what I want to happen for them. I think at this point, Rick, if it's okay, as I scratch my little itchy allergy nose, this might be a time to open the mic and see if anybody has any questions about those principles. We'll maybe take 3 or 4 minutes, take 2 or 3 questions, and then close the mics again. I really want you to hear Beth's story, which I think operationalizes a lot of these principles, and hear that from her, and then we'll take a few more questions and then close.
Okay, thanks, Helen. For those of you who have a comment or questions, there are 2 ways that you can present them to Helen and Beth. One would be to hit *6 on your keypad, and that will open up your line so that we can hear you. The second would be to use the chat feature in the webinar if you're following on the webinar screen, and you can just type on the bottom left-hand side a message, and we'll be able to track that question or comment that you have there. So again, if you have a question or a comment, just hit star 6 on your keypad and we'll be able to hear you. So dive on in.
You should
Hello,
know
Lauren,
silence.
Just to make sure we're not having a technology glitch, Helen, I will open up all the lines automatically. I'm not sure. The volume might be too loud, but that way, in case anyone's having difficulty getting through, they'll be able to. And I do see
one typed question. Yes.
Right.
The typed question is, was Beth adopted at birth, and how long have you had contact with her birth mother? She was actually 7 weeks old when she came to our home, and the adoption was finalized when she we have, I think, been in reunion status about a year and a half. So, we'll tell you more about how that process happened. Beth will tell you that in a few minutes, but about 18 months now. Thanks for that question, Kelly. What are the keys to push on our phones to mute and unmute? I'll let Rick answer that.
Good, I just did.
You already did, I see that. Okay, good.
I had a question.
Okay, so now all the lines are unmuted, Helen, automatically.
Okay. Yes, ma'am?
My question just related back to, and maybe Beth will get into some of this too, just early developmental years. I'm an adoptive mom of two. Two of my three children were adopted, and my three siblings were also all adopted. So I come from that background. But as a mother now, my oldest of the two adopted children is now approaching 11 years old. And I'm just kind of curious, just developmentally, what kinds of questions perhaps arose for Beth during those years specifically.
Beth, do you want to answer that?
And I'll get more in. I'll get more into this a little bit later, but my questions around that age period were more centered around, who do I look like? Why was I given up? Things of that nature. I did experience, there was grief involved. Even with a person I only have a picture of. I also have an older sister who was not adopted, who grew up with Jennifer. And I wanted to know a lot about her as well. And I'll get more into that reunion a little bit later also.
Good. Yeah. Well, I think the developmental stages certainly are And then sometimes had questions about actually how, what actually had happened and how that worked. When she became a young adolescent, she had more questions about who she looked like, sounded like. And I think some of those are identity formation questions. I don't know who I am, but it may not be you, so who am I? I'm gonna answer one more question, and then we're going to hear from Beth. What ideas do you have for children whose birth parents die before they can experience a healthy relationship with them? And I think that's a great question. My life's work has been working in the area of hospice and loss. After I left the children's home, that's the work I did for the next almost 20 years. And I think there are many ways to help children relate to a person who is gone. The more you can find out about the strengths and positives in that person, certainly drug use and overdose would not be a strength, but my hunch is there are lots of things that are positive and wonderful and strong about them, perhaps talents they had, or friendships they had, or skills they had. And so if you can find out those and see what connections kids, your children have with those, that I think that's important to do. I also think there are ways to have relationship with people after they die by writing them letters or journaling to them, or, you know, ways to express your feelings about them. And there may be some extended family beyond that parent who's died who might look like them or have relationship. So if you want to stay on after, we can talk about some more possibilities, Jolene. But I think right now, Rick, why don't we go ahead and mute the phones, and let's hear from Beth.
Okay. Beth, back to you.
Thank you. What we decided as a consequence of the Alan Keith Lucas principles was to love her birth parents, to love them, to pray for them, to value their contribution. We decided to tell Beth a story. We decided to say from the beginning, we don't know if there'll be a reunion someday, but if you want one, we'll help you look and participate in that. We decided that when she was sad because she couldn't be with them, that we would let her grieve and we would grieve with her. We decided to write those letters every year so that there would be a chronology of her life available to them one day. And when she was ready to search, we decided to participate in the search. And so I'll let you now hear from her about that.
Hi. I'm a little nervous, so bear with me. My format is basically going to be, I'm just going to go through some of the principles that we already talked about and outline how they specifically apply to our story. The first one of those is to never rule out the biological family. I don't ever remember not knowing that I was adopted. It was my bedtime story from when I first came to live with my parents. You know, once upon a time, there was a mommy who already had a daughter, and she didn't have financial resources, et cetera, to raise another one. So she loved her little girl that she was pregnant with so much that she wanted to be able to give her everything, and so she looked for other mommies and daddies who could take care of her for her. You know, just a bedtime story that made it relatable to me at such a young age. And I've always been very open about it. I've never been ashamed of being adopted, even you know, even when there are mean kids in the seventh grade who say you were just unwanted or you were just thrown away or things like that. And that never really fazed me because I knew better, because I've always known that that Jennifer was just a special person in our lives. But still, even being able to grow up with such wonderful parents and a big brother, I felt that something was missing. And to this day, I can't really articulate what it was, but I always sensed its absence. And you know, like my mom said, when I was about 7 years old, I came up to her in tears, just repeating, "I miss my birth mother." And you know, I was acknowledging, you know, I mean, that matters. And I was acknowledging a specific person in our lives who is very important to us. And even though we had never met her, and like I said, I only had one picture of her and a letter that she wrote to me while she was pregnant with me. You know, it she mattered in our lives. Starting when I was about 14 or 15, I was trying to figure out who I was supposed to be, where I was going with my life. And I felt very stuck. I didn't know where I could go if I didn't know my roots, if I didn't know, you know, what parts of me came from where, you know, what parts of me are genetic, what parts of me are the environment I was raised in, and what parts of me are just me inherently. And that was very hard for me, but, you know, just with the good foundation that I did have with my parents and good friends and things like that, I've been able to, you know, come through that. The second principle that really resonated with me is that if a child doesn't find something to love and appreciate in their family of origin, they won't be able to find something to love and appreciate in themselves. You know, my mom and my dad always spoke of Jennifer's love for me. I've always known that I was loved completely unconditionally. As I got older, my mom did express to me her grief that I couldn't grow up with my biological family. And that was something I had always thought but never really wanted to say. So I'm glad that she was able to tell me that. But she also expressed her joy that I was able to grow up with her and my dad and my brother. And so I grew up with a pretty good self-esteem because I knew that my roots were good and that my situation came, you know, from a very hard situation but turned out into something beautiful and wonderful on all sides. Painful on all sides as well, but it turned out for good. And like I said, I was always proud of being adopted. I was never ashamed of it. And I was always proud of Jennifer for being able to make such a hard decision that, she was my age when she got pregnant with me, and I can't even imagine being in that situation and having to make that decision. And so I've always been proud of her for that. One of the other principles is that feelings and personal relationships really matter. Like my mom said, she wrote an update letter every year on my birthday. And some years, I think I remember a couple years, I wrote my own letter to include, I think one when I was like 12 and one before that. I never knew until about a year and a half ago that they were ever read. But I think knowing that they were sent was enough for me. It was enough to establish some sort of connection with her out wherever she was. I never knew if they were read or not, but just knowing they were sent was enough for me. So when I was a senior in high school, a few months before I turned 18, I began to ask in earnest. You know, I really wanted to meet this person that I had always heard about and I always wanted a connection with. So we talked to my social worker. Her name is Diane. We talked with her, and she was my social worker who facilitated the whole process in the first place when I was a baby. And she found my sister on Facebook who had kept Jennifer's maiden name so that we would be able to find her someday because Jennifer had gotten remarried 10 years before. So we decided to make contact, and Diane called Jennifer, and Jennifer was very excited and embraced a connection with us. And my mom wanted to talk with her first, I guess as sort of a protection measure for me. just to talk about, what a meeting would look like, if it was the best time, things like that. And my mom wanted Jennifer to have the letters before she and I talked. We found out that Jennifer did pick up the letters for about the first 3 years of my life, but it became much too painful for her. The thought of, me growing up without her was much too painful for her to watch every year. So she stopped after about 3 years. So we sent the rest of them for her to read, to have some background on me before we talked. And she was very appreciative of that. She said it was like watching me grow up through a window. And she was very excited to be able to do that. So we decided to meet that Labor Day, that September, my first semester here at Baylor, my first week here at Baylor. So Jennifer and her husband, Chet, who is not my biological father, but was very good friends with Jennifer while she was pregnant with me. So he has been present through this whole process, and later told me he thinks of me as his own daughter also. They both came to Waco to meet with us, and we met at their hotel on a Friday morning, and I was really nervous, and I didn't really know what to expect. I didn't really know what she looked like. I wasn't sure what was about to happen, but I was just so excited. And then we walked into the hotel lobby, and we just fell into each other's arms because we knew each other as soon as we saw each other, and started sobbing uncontrollably. And we both said, "It's really nice to meet you." And I don't know what all the other people in the hotel lobby were thinking, but it didn't really matter. You know, it was all those years of that Jennifer-shaped hole in my life were filled, and I was finally whole. It was like that grieving process just completely stopped. And we went to breakfast, me and Jennifer and Chet and my mom and dad. I had breakfast with my two parents, and it was so surreal being able to, you know, be with my birth mother and have her hold me for the first time since I was born. I don't know if many people get to do that. I don't know if our story is very common, but I consider myself so incredibly blessed to have been able to do that. So I went to class later that day, and my mom and Jennifer walked around campus, and I still marvel at how much they are alike in temperament and values, and it's incredible to see them together. And for my mom to talk about things that I did when I was a toddler, and for Jennifer to talk about things that my sister did when she was a toddler, and how alike me and my sister are, and just for them to have mom talk together is really cool to watch. And I also noticed that, you know, Jennifer and I have a lot of the same mannerisms. We talk a little bit the same way. We have a lot of the same facial expressions, which is very interesting to see. And it's been a lot of fun. We went to a football game at my high school. The big rivalry game, and it was really fun. And but you know, we come from a very small town, and as soon as people started to figure out who Jennifer was, we were instantly the talk of the night. And it was this huge deal. And anyway, it was a lot of fun to see people that I grew up with being able to celebrate this with us. And I think it was very special for Jennifer to be able to see where I grew up, and to be able to put, you know, faces with names, and places with, you know, names of places that we put in the letters, and sort of be able to see a more complete picture of my life. My mom kept a baby book from, of course, when I was born until when I was, I don't know, like 15 or so. And we made a copy of that for Jennifer to have so she could see my little footprints and all my milestones, and so she could have that part of me as well. All in all, the weekend was just more than we ever hoped for. It was, everything went wonderful, and we've kept up contact. I've seen them several times since then. I've met my sister, who is a year and a half older than I am. And she's just a wonderful person also. And we're very much alike. We make our coffee the exact same way. In fact, when the day we met, we met for breakfast, and we made our coffee the same way simultaneously, sitting next to each other, and our moms just laughed at us. And that was also very cool to see. And we have, you know, similar interests, and I've always wanted an older sister growing up with an older brother. it's been cool to have a relationship with her also. You know, like I said, growing up, I wanted to know what parts of me came from where, what parts of me came from genetics and from my environment and things like that. And that question was answered for me by a poem that now is hung on my bedroom wall. And it ends with the quote, you know, heredity or environment, which are you the product of? And it says, neither, my darling, neither, just two different kinds of love. And I've always loved that. Just, you know, that it really doesn't matter what parts of me come from where, but that I am loved by so many different wonderful people and loved unconditionally. So.
Yeah. So since that first reunion, Beth got to meet her birth sister, and then we had a weekend together with both families where she met, pardon me, her aunt and some cousins, a grandmother, and then we were able to send her to, she was able to go for a week to spend with her birth mother and father in their home, and then since then we've all been up there to visit together. So the saga just continues; it keeps getting better and better. I don't want to play Pollyanna with you all and tell you that this is all easy. It is possible because we love each other, because we give each other the benefit of the doubt, because we've decided together that whatever makes Beth whole and healthy and happy is what we all want. And so we value each other's contributions to her lives. And Jennifer and I talk about that. So it's not about, you know, it doesn't have to be about, you know, jealousy or turf or being afraid that she'll love one and not the other. What we've discovered is that love multiplies. It doesn't divide. I think, Rick, this might be a time to open for questions again as we approach the end, especially if anybody has a question about one of the test questions that we didn't answer.
Again, there'll be two ways that you can pose questions or comments to Helen and Beth. One would be, as Kelly has already done, to jot down a question on the chat screen, or if you on your telephone hit *6, you'll be able to be heard by Beth and Helen as well. So again, either on the chat screen or *6, please feel free to on your mind.
Okay, I have kind of a comment and a question.
Yes, sir.
I've been in this field for about 30 years, and when I first started in the children's home field, a lot of facilities were more on the orphanage side of things, and I don't know if we ever said it out loud, but and it wasn't just our facility. I think the system functioned kind of with an attitude toward birth parents or toward abusive or neglectful parents that, well, you've forfeited your right to take care of this kid by your behavior, and you get out of the way and let us show you how it's done. And, you know, over the years, we, not only through observation, but looking at scripture and looking at, well, not necessarily Alan Keith Lucas principles, but certainly just by learning, stepping back, looking at how God still chose to bring this child into the world, that we did an about face to really value the natural parent, regardless of their behavior, their station in life, whether they're incarcerated or not. Because some of the very things you talked about, it's still, for that child, it's still their parent. And
That's right.
We in our facility, about 1995, really instituted across the board what we call family-focused residential child care, where we work really hard to engage families as allies. And it's difficult It's not always successful, but I was just reminded, and you've reinforced so many of the things that we've learned and that we continue to try to do here. And when parents do engage with us, and the child knows it, that we're teaming up together for that child's better future, it's amazing to see how much better progress the child makes.
Well, that's right. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. And I want to encourage you to continue that, because even when it doesn't work today, it doesn't mean it won't work tomorrow or next week or next year for that child. People don't always stay in the same level of difficulty, and so we keep hoping. One of the questions here is, how do you handle it when a child fantasizes that living with their birth parents would be better than living with their adoptive parents? And my experience is to express wishes as wishes. There may be things that would be better living with a birth parent or different. And so, you know, what I said to Beth several times was, you know, I wish that things could have worked out for you where that might have happened for you. And I think if it had, there'd be good days and bad days there too. And so what we deal with is the reality that we have, and understanding that maybe someday you'll have that opportunity, and just expressed it as a wish. Kelly, I'm not really aware of resources or networks for birth parents. I should be, and so I'll certainly check into that and email Rick with whatever I find out, and he can pass that on to you, okay? Looks like you have some to share. I appreciate that, and I hope folks are able to write those down. Ronald, 8C and 8D seem correct to you, and so let me tell you what I think. I'm looking there for D. There are people who need each other, because even when children are needy, honestly, we were as needy as Beth. Beth needed a good home, and we needed to be parents. And she met as much need in us as we did in her, maybe more. We adopted Beth in, where did we adopted you in, you were born in 92, so we adopted Beth in 1992. and really, she did not have previous memories, which were bad, but I do think certainly with older children adoption that can happen, and the Keith Lucas principle would be to find the balance between reality, empathy, and support. And so when memories are bad, you deal with the reality of the bad memory, the painful memory, and you express how much you care about that pain and how much you're there to help them with the pain. And then I think the other part of the frame is, things are never all bad, and so what is the positive that comes out of that as well? And I think certainly some parents' circumstances are very difficult for children, and sometimes they've been abusive with children, and we don't gloss over that reality. But every memory and every experience is rarely negative, and so whatever we can find to help children understand that there's a balance in relationships, the better they do. Kelly, thanks for those resources. Anybody else? I think, Rick, we might be out of time. So, you know, let me sum up how we appreciate the thing. What is it, Rick?
We actually go to 2:15, so you've got a bit of time.
Oh, that's great. Good.
2:15 this time or
what? That would be 1:15 our time. Good. So we've got a few more minutes to chat. As you continue to type or present questions, we'll certainly answer them. But let me emphasize a couple of things. One is, Beth told you about that nighttime story that we told. And I think sometimes helping children with their own narrative is really important. Children fantasize That is normal and appropriate. And so helping children create their own narrative where they can identify what is a wish and what is a dream and what is a memory is really important. I think life books and life story books are very valuable for kids to have, and I hope you consider that as a resource, whatever setting you're working in with children. Beth went to Montessori preschool, and they have something at her Montessori where instead of singing Happy Birthday, they sang Celebration of Life, and the children carried the globe around the sun, one round for each year of life. So when she was five, she went around five times. And during that time, the parent got to tell part of her story. And so we created a Celebration of Life book. But we included in there the information about Jennifer. And not only did Jennifer leave a letter and a photo for Beth, but she had crocheted a baby blanket for her, which was it's still a treasure of Beth's. So we tried to build in everything positive, recognize wishes as wishes, recognize that Don and I, while we think we're decent parents, are not perfect parents either. We've made mistakes through the years. We don't do everything perfectly. And so we ask for our children's grace and love and positive regard even when we make mistakes, so we don't see ourselves as being the perfect parent and the birth parents as being the bad parents. And I think that balance helps children understand, you know, there's wonderful stuff about them, and then they're human and make mistakes too. Can you touch on privacy issues? Yeah, that's a great, you know, if Jennifer and the rest of the birth family had said, we don't want a reunion, or we want a reunion, but we want this to be our business, we would not feel the same freedom that we feel sharing the story. Jennifer and Chet and the rest of the family are happy for us to share the story. And in fact, we've talked about figuring out a way that they could be part of events like this where we tell the story and Jennifer could tell her part of the story. I want Beth to always be able to own her story and tell her story. Part of what I think I know about her is that this is our story. I don't have a story without her, and I don't have a story without Jennifer. And so we do this together. I don't know if that answers your question, Kelly, but I think we just very much feel like this is our story.
You've got mail.
When did you tell Beth that she was adopted? I started doing the Once Upon a Time There Was a Baby. There was a mommy who was going to have a baby, and the mommy was having a hard time. She didn't have a job, and she didn't have a house, and she worried about how she was going to take care of her baby. And then she heard about that sometimes there were mommies and daddies who couldn't have a baby or couldn't take care of a baby, and she tried to find out if there was a mommy and a daddy that could be a mommy and a daddy to her baby, because she couldn't right then at that time in her life. And so we did that Once Upon a Time story starting when she was very, very little. She's always known she was adopted. We've talked about, as Christians, how we're all adopted, that God adopts us into his family, that without adoption, none of us would even have a relationship with our father. And so we see adoption as being a positive thing, the decision to place as being a loving, nurturing, caring thing. If her circumstances were different, and say she had been removed from her birth parents by CPS and they didn't agree with the adoption, then the narrative would be a little different. Then the narrative would be, sometimes a mommy or a daddy can't take care of a child the way they need to be taken care of, and sometimes other people make the decision that child needs to be cared for somewhere else. But I think you deal with the reality, expressing how much you care about the feelings, and then provide the support. Kelly, the mulberry bird is an excellent story. Thank you for sharing that resource as well. Anybody else out there have experience with the works of Alan Keith Lucas? Because our story is fun to share. Part of the takeaway I hope for all of you will be that there are some incredible resources out there that can help inform both our professional and our personal lives. Keith has a wonderful book called Giving and Taking Help, which is available on the NACSW website book list, where he really talks about, as Christian helpers, the kinds of things we can do that help our clients be successful, and the kinds of things sometimes we do that get in the way of clients making the change and progress they need to. He also has a little wonderful book that we use with all of our students here at Baylor called So You Want to Be a Social Worker. The subtitle is a Primer for the Christian Student, and really goes a long way toward helping students begin that conversation around what does it mean to be a Christian and a social worker. He's got a fantastic little book called Encounters with Children, where he tells the narrative of 8 different children that he worked with at a variety of different children's homes who were struggling with their own issues of adolescence and family issues and who am I and where am I going and what am I going to be. And those narratives reinforce the principles by giving you sort of some stories to connect them to. So I'd really encourage you to look at some of those resources as well. Is there another question out there? Emily, yes, Jesus himself was adopted. Isn't that amazing how God has provided for us the examples and prototypes and all the possibilities? Yeah, I've never heard anybody talk about God the Father being a bad father because he gave up his child for adoption.
Helen, I think we'll have time for perhaps 1 to 2 more questions. Again, anyone,
okay,
if you'd like to be heard, you can press *6 on your keypad, or if you're on the webinar portion, you can type in your question or comment on the chat section.
Beth, is there something else you want to say about in response to any of the questions?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Jan, and I dialed in late. I finally got connected up with your website. Hi, I've really enjoyed listening to you. I'm sorry that I missed part of you. I'm struggling with one of the questions. I must have missed it when I was not dialed in early, is number 4 on your post-test, and I'm curious to know what that answer is.
Okay, number 4, the 3 primary elements in effective helping are reality, the facts as they are, helping people understand their reality, empathy, mm-hmm, communicating that we care about their pain, that is frequently the result of the facts, and support, the notion that not only do we care, but we're here to make things different, to help them get through it and have what they need to make things different. And the wonderful thing about when Keith Lucas talks about this in several of his books, he compares or makes the analogy that's much like the Trinity. God the Father represents reality, things as they are. Jesus Christ, the supreme example of empathy, loving us, being there with us, understanding our circumstance. And the Holy Spirit as support, the comforter, the bringer of wisdom, the supportive part of the Trinity through all of our experiences. So the answer to that question is reality, empathy, and support.
Beautiful. Thank you. I'm sorry that I missed it. Glad to get that piece.
You bet. Thank you. Kelly, I think when adoptive parents are resistant or hesitant to have open communication with birth family, frequently, I think it's because they're protective of those children. And I really understand that. We have the mistaken notion, I think, that if we pretend like something's not there, it can't hurt someone. And the truth is, I think Beth has communicated beautifully that she always felt like something was missing. Now, you know, things worked out beautifully for us. Jennifer's amazing. The family's amazing. The question sometimes comes, you know, what happens, you know, what would have happened if Jennifer was a prostitute, if Jennifer was, incarcerated, if Jennifer was an alcoholic and actively drinking. And my answer to that would be twofold. First of all, that's part of Beth's reality, and she would have a right to know that and to manage that. In Keith's book, Encounters with Children, there's a one story about a girl who's dealing with exactly that kind of situation where the birth family's not making good choices or in difficult circumstances that are challenging and would be challenging to this child. And the children's home folks are trying to protect her from that. And she says at some point, I know it's hard, but it's my hard. And what I need is for you to help me with my hard, not to pretend like it's not there. I also think that when children speculate, they frequently speculate about worse than any reality. And so the question then really becomes, how do we help them deal with what their reality is, caring about them and supporting them through it? Now, certainly there could be some developmental times when we say this is not the best time to introduce that piece of reality. And I think that's the purview and right of the parent. And that's not just true about birth families. I mean, we do that around lots of things, don't we? I mean, I didn't let Beth drive a car when she was 8 years old because as much as she might have wanted to, she wasn't ready for that developmentally. So I think there's some judgment calls we have to make. But I think we start with, yes, it is your appropriate position and right and responsibility to protect your child, but you best protect your child by being a part of them dealing with whatever their reality is. Because it's not helpful if later they go find out that reality and have to deal with it without you and without your love and without your care. I think the second piece of that is people are not one thing. Someone who struggles with alcoholism is called an alcoholic, but that doesn't mean that's all there is about them. So they may be very smart. They may be very musically talented. I shared with a student the other day, we were talking about persons with schizophrenia and asked them if they'd seen the movie or read the book The Soloist, which is a true story about a man who struggles with schizophrenia but is an amazing musician. And, you know, so to help people understand the whole picture of a person helps them find out what the positives are that are inside them as well.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.